the next mile, to break sight to the blind man, and sound to the left child, we will survive, in this time to wilderness, swimming through the waters of Babylon, like a rebel fish, jungleist, specialist, predatory and survivalist, spitting heaven's fire from his lips, burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. With all that getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, it's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there, or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app, and in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening Media is there. Always follow the latest podcast of the various programs on Time for an Awakening, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace in our partnership with the BB2Me. Always interesting things being put in the marketplace all the time. African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 7:08 here in the city of Philadelphia. And tonight, we have a special guest joining us in conversation, author, financial educator, and CEO of Good Steward LLC, Sean D. Rochester, will be with us this evening. The Black Tax, the cost of being black in America, and related topics will be the topic of discussion this evening with our special guest, Mr. Sean D. Rochester. And we'll be right back to talk with our guest after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Not a Wu-Tanger. All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard. Is with us, Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. The clock done sprung forward. The temperature done rose. Did you say, how you say that? Rose or rise? One of them. And Brother Man was, you know, like just strolling around saying, okay, now let this stay. But I'm definitely excited to speak with Mr. Rochester this evening, you know, because I think that this is really a continuation of a dialogue that we've been having in relationship to solutions and understanding the situation we're in. And I believe he provides a really cogent and what's that, fact-based understanding in the Black tax of what our relationship is and have been into to this country, and therefore what we have to do. And, you know, and I think it's, you know, I just want to raise this point, you know, in getting, as you begin to speak to the guests tonight, that I've seen that, you know, I think it was last year or the discussion came out about the Institute for Policy Studies saying that Black household wealth is on a track to reach zero by 2082. And I just think that Mr. Rochester provides us possibly why, but more importantly, you know, what we need to do to not make that a reality. So I'm very excited for our discussion tonight.
And I'm glad he's on with us, because we usually talk about a lot of these issues, and we kind of pride ourselves, Richard, of putting historical perspective on our situation here. Mr. Rochester does the same thing with his book, The Black Tax, The Cost of Being Black in America. But he does it with the numbers. He puts the fact-based numbers in with our historical perspective, in with the situations that we have found ourselves in historically in this country, and puts it out there so people can critically look at the numbers, critically look at our situation, and assess what we need to do. I'm glad to have him on with us, and I think this is him on hold. Let me pull him up. Mr. Rochester, is this you?
I am on.
Thanks for being with us, Mr. Rochester. Myself and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening.
Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, thank you very much for having me on the program. I greatly appreciate it.
Mr. Rochester, Richard turned me on to your work, and I've been looking at it now, knowing that you were going to be our guest for the past, I guess, 3 weeks. Before we kind of get into it, talk about why you wrote the book, The Black Tax, Cost of Being Black in America. What was the impetus behind you doing this and putting all the raw figures and numbers out there so we all can see this and understand it?
So I'll try to give you the short version,
okay,
of a longer version. But there's a couple of things. I wanted to be able to attack the wealth gap that exists between Black Americans and white Americans, which we all are familiar with and talk about quite a bit. And I wanted to approach that in two ways. One was to stimulate demand for Black products and services and for commercializing Black businesses. The other, which I did in a separate book, was about how do we increase the wisdom, knowledge, and understanding amongst our group and our families to be able to manage our limited resources in a better way, to retain more income, eliminate debt, and to be able to leave an inheritance for our children's children. With the Black Tax in particular, I wanted to put together the strongest possible case for commercializing Black business. But I think we all know that if you just start with that, people will give you 100 different reasons why they don't want to do business with a Black service provider or a firm, right? Might be issues associated with quality or a whole host of things. It generally sounds a little bit like people approach it as a charity, I'll kind of help you out, or they approach it as a burden or a cost. So my perspective was, if we're going to think about it in those terms, particularly being somewhat of a cost to us, helping each other out, then I wanted to show people what the real cost was for us all right now. And that led me down, you know, a path of looking at the financial cost of discrimination. I think you guys will probably have realized, you know, every several months, you know, 6 months, 8 months, there's always an article about discrimination that's happening in a market that's really important for wealth accumulation for Black people, whether it's, you know, housing or the job search and other things. And I would see those things and I would collect them. And as I read them, they always felt like it was a cost to me, like it was a tax. So I started down the path of looking at, you know, what the cost was, what researchers said that the cost was. And then I did a look back over time, and I thought I was going to do a quick summation of, you know, things that we were familiar with, but I wanted to look at it from an economic perspective. And going down that path took me down a much deeper dive. It's almost like when you start pulling at a string in a sweater, the whole thing starts to unravel the more you pull at it. So the first thing was to show people what the economic cost is and has been for Black people because of discrimination, and that a cost affects our ability to accumulate wealth. And it has affected our ability to accumulate wealth over the last, 400 years. And that journey took me down a path of helping to explain why it is that we only own about 2% of U.S. wealth. And then the final part was to introduce an economic framework that I call PhD, which stands for Purchase, Hire, and Deposit in ways that create jobs, create and expand businesses, and provide capital in the Black community. Because almost all the socioeconomic problems that we are dealing with are stemming from those three major gaps, right? The gap of jobs, businesses, and capital. So PhD says we need to be properly reflected on your payroll. We need to be properly reflected in your supply chain. When companies are buying products and services, they should buy it from Black enterprise. And individuals and companies need to be providing liquidity in our communities because our businesses need it to fund growth. And if you're not doing one of those three things or all three of them, you're not doing anything. It's not helpful from an economic perspective. And that was kind of the impetus behind it. But as you can imagine, you start to learn an extraordinary amount of things about the history that Black people in America have had to endure.
Mr. Rochester, when these subjects come up, and especially without a critical analysis, when these subjects come up in loose conversations, somebody might see a news report or hear a talk program, and these subjects come up in loose conversations among both white, mm-hmm. and you hear Blacks mentioning, yep. Black folks, our people not really trying, as an excuse, stop using that as a crutch. Things like that. You hear, Caucasians talk about pull up your bootstraps, things of that nature.
Right.
But when you delve into the numbers and you went into a historical perspective in your book,
yep.
to talk about slavery, and see, you have to. Most folks don't want to talk about that, especially Caucasians. But in order to get a clear picture of what we're dealing with, you have to go back there when you're talking about our people. Talk about how you went back there and started drawing the numbers up from our situation as enslaved population to Jim Crow to the present.
Yeah. So, in the examples that you gave, right, where people say, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It was a really long, a long time ago. You guys are always kind of complaining. All of that is what you say when you don't have information and context, or that you believe that the trauma was small to insignificant. It was clearly surmountable, right? It's a very qualitative conversation that people have. So I went back and I wanted to look at what is the financial cost of slavery, right, for Black people. And one of the first things that you have to, understand is that slavery by definition is a 100% tax on your labor, right? And there's many things that you could never price or value during that period of time of slavery. You could never price what it is to be, a man and not be able to protect your wife or your daughter, or, enjoy the fruits of your labor or your enterprise. You could never price what it is to be a woman and be unable to control and protect your body over the entirety of your life, right? But there are some things that you can price, and you can price the labor extracted from millions of people over almost a 250-year period. And economists have made estimates of that, and some put it as high as, 24 trillion, others put it as high as 97 trillion. And if you assume the truth is in the middle, and you take an average of those, you're talking about up to $50 trillion. Right? Labor extracted from millions of Black people over a 200-year period in today's equivalent dollars. And then what else you can do? Because that seems like an enormous number that people are unfamiliar with. But the other thing that you can do is you can price the value of the 4 million people that were held in bondage in 1860, right before the Civil War, right? So it turns out that that value is so large that economists measure it either in terms of national wealth, right, or in terms of national income, which they call GDP. So from a national wealth perspective, it's expected to be between 16 and 20% of national wealth, right? That is an enormous number. That's roughly about $15.5 trillion, because national wealth is about $85 trillion, and 16 to 20% of that is $14 to $17 trillion. And if you take an average of those, it puts you at 15.5. That's just one way of valuing the value of those people in today's equivalent. Now, if you look at it from an income perspective, economists say that their value is roughly between 1 and 2 years of national income. Well, national income today is about $19 trillion a year. So 1 to 2 trillion of that is 19 to 38 trillion. If you take an average, you're at 28.5. So if you look at one method of valuing those people, it's about 28.5 trillion. If you look at another method of valuing them, you're at 15.5. If you take an average of those two things, which we do in valuation, now you're at $22 trillion. Mm. It's an enormous sum, right? When you start looking at it in terms of what is it in today's equivalent, it answers the question of whether or not it was a big deal. It answers the question of whether or not it was easy to surmount and get over with, because people have no idea of the scale or the enormity, right, of what these people meant to the U.S. economy. You got to remember that, you know, the 4 million people held in bondage in the South are producing the raw cotton, right? And that raw cotton is 61% of U.S. exports. And the cotton market globally was the equivalent of like the oil market today. 20 million people employed in it around the world. A million of those people lose their job during the Civil War. It affects the entire world, right? And the U.S. dominates 80% of that market. It's a complete monopoly. You cannot beat free labor, right? So when you think about the economic impact of these folks, those 4 million people are fully 50% of the full economic value of the South. You understand why people are going to war to preserve that. That's not an issue about anything other than economics.
Yes. Okay.
Right?
All right.
So once you start to speak about this in terms of, you know, what are the numbers at the end of the day? Not how I feel about it. That's irrelevant. Not what I believe about it. That doesn't have to be tied to reality. What are the numbers, right, saying about it? That's how I wanted to approach it. And then, you know, people say, well, you know, it was a long time ago, and, you know, but you've had 152, 153 years to build wealth. Well, the issue here is that people left bondage without economic resources, right? It wasn't like, you know, when, you know, the Hebrews left Egypt and they were favorably disposed, right? The Egyptians gave them wealth, according to the Bible. There was no wealth given to newly freed people. In 1870, Black people owned 0.17% of U.S. wealth. It's not zero, but it's effectively zero. So how were you going to position yourself? There was no 40 acres and a mule that was distributed. And if you do the math on that number, that would have been the equivalent of about $1 trillion today. That was never provided to them. But yet, 1.5 million white families received 246 million acres of land through the Homestead Act, which is the equivalent of about $1.6 trillion, or roughly $1 million a family. You know what I mean? Once you start to look at the numbers, it starts to be self-evident, right? So you got trillions extracted from people, and not even $1 trillion is provided to them, which would be 2% of what was taken from their ancestors, right? So now you're starting in a position where you have no economic resources. And you go through the short period of Reconstruction, which everyone kind of talks about, but that closes out very quickly. And then you go into a nightmare of Jim Crow, right? Yeah. And Jim Crow is a response to the global cotton famine, because you got to put these people back to work.
Now before, go ahead. Finish your thought, Mr. Rochester. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you know what I mean. And it's like, how are you going to do that? Right. No. You have to have massive, abundant labor. Right. And you have to have the laws and the structure around that to be able to encourage that. And that's where you get into the vagrancy laws, right? Where you have to prove that you're a landowner or you have a job or you can be arrested. You know, so once you start to walk through that process and then you look at the structure around it and the economic impact, a lot of things start to become clear and self-evident. How could these people accumulate wealth and resources under those just draconian circumstances that were imposed upon them? The going thought is that we impose this stuff, you know, on ourselves here and around the world. And the data and the history doesn't bear that out.
You know, before you go up into the Jim Crow era, I want to kind of go right back. But Richard, go ahead, because I know you want to mention some things.
Yeah, you know, because the other side that you explore, Ms. Rochester, that I think, let me go back and say I appreciate you laying out that there is a supply chain, and you lay out a kind of method of how it can be resolved. But going to this part that you explored, and that was the implicit and explicit bias, because it seems that for me, and I want you to respond to that, if it is so, that becomes the invisible hand that drives the need to do these other things in relationship to the economic system that this labor and the tax on Black people is applied. Go through how you derive the understanding about this, the impact of this implicit and explicit bias.
Yeah, so the Black tax is the financial cost of discrimination against Black people in America that is driven by individuals and our institutions that are acting on explicit or implicit bias, right? And one of the things that it's important to understand is that the explicit and implicit bias levels, anti-Black bias levels, I'm being very specific here, right, in terms of Black people, it's very high in the United States, right? So researchers from, you know, Stanford or other places in Chicago, Michigan, and Associated Press have looked at what is the level of explicit bias, like conscious, people know exactly what they're doing. And some have put that number at 50%, right, of the population or the electorate. That's 1 in 2. And then when they looked at what is the implicit, and implicit is just a fancy word for unconscious, right, bias. As bias that you are acting on that you are not fully aware of, it's almost 60%, right? And then Harvard has been doing research on this for many, many years. And they have this online test called an IAT, an implicit association test. So to measure a subconscious bias, an implicit bias, a bias that a person is not aware of, what they do is they are essentially exposing you to various images and then exposing you to images of white males and Black males. And they are measuring how quickly you can associate positive things with white people and positive things or negative things with Black people, right? So what they're measuring is what they call automatic white preference, the ease with which you can associate good things and the rapidity of it with images and thoughts of white people. And what they have found from their research, and millions of people, tens of millions of people have taken the online racial IAT test on Harvard, and anyone can go do it. At approaching about 75% of those people demonstrated automatic white preference. That's almost 8 in 10, right? It's powerful. So what I want people to understand is the source is white preference and automatic and anti-Black bias. We are just observing it manifesting itself in different ways. You observe it in the job pool when people don't respond to you because you have a Black sounding name. You ob- observe it in the credit pool when you are getting treated differently, even though your credit is the same. You observe it in the mortgage industry. You observe it in the interaction with police, right? It's how you associate, the association with Black people is different, the interpretation of the actions and even the work product, right? And we can talk about some of those studies that, that were done. People come with to a different conclusion when they think that the action or the work product was done by a Black person. So I wasn't interested in that just for the sake of being interested. I was interested in how does that manifest itself in an economic cost to Black people? Because that's what I have a problem with. Not that it exists, but that it has an economic impact, negative economic impact on Black people.
And I like to you to just emphasize at least that one part that I heard you develop, and that is, I think it was with law firms, because it shows something clear. And as you say, these studies go on along web, but on two levels, it shows just the whole biasness and how it plays out and supposedly dealing with facts on one side. But as you say, it shows for those who are at the upper range of income level, the effect in the long term of the economic or the tax that they pay for being Black because of this bias. And that is with this law firm you explored that. I think that came out of the Chicago study, or was that the Harvard study?
Yeah, the Chicago study referred to measuring bias in the labor market, and that was with the names on the resumes, right? And then if you look at the high income careers, right, you would think that at those levels, people are just more objective, right? They've been through years and years of education at the highest levels. There's all types of screening and down selection that goes into people who go into these ultra high end careers. Surely there would be more objectivity, right? And those ranks. So there was a firm, I think it was called NextGen, that wanted to take a look at discrimination in the legal industry. So what they did was they created a legal memo, and they by an associate, and they inserted 21 errors in that memo, right? And then they sent the memo off to law partners at large firms. And one group, they told the partners at the law firm that it was a Black associate who wrote the memo. For another group of partners at major law firms, they told them it was a white associate. So for the group that thought it was, you know, a white associate, they gave that memo an overall rating of roughly about 4 out of 5, right? It's like 80%, you know, maybe it's a B, B minus, something like that. Nothing to write home about, but that's a pretty good grade for something with 21 errors in it, right? And these are errors in spelling, errors in grammar, errors in the fact, analysis of the fact, so on and so forth, right? And then for the group that thought it was written by a Black associate or lawyer, they gave it a grade of about 3.1 out of 5, right? So that's a failing grade in every district and every school. and not only did they give them a failing grade, but when asked about what they thought their future potential would be to be a partner, it was very negative. They didn't associate this person with that. Now, mind you, it's the same exact work product. It's just based on who you believe wrote it. Now, in those errors, they had 21 errors in spelling and grammar, right? Errors that you could discern quite easily. When they thought it was a white person, for the group of partners that thought it was a white person, they only caught 6 out of the 7 errors. But when they thought it was a Black person, they caught when they thought it was a white person that wrote it, they only caught 3 of the 7 errors, 3 out of the 7. But when they thought it was a Black person, they caught 6 out of the 7 errors, 100% more errors, and the same exact work product, right? There is just more scrutiny that is being provided to the very same work product if somebody believes that it is, you know, a Black attorney. I mean, would it be nice for someone to observe 50% less of whatever is the matter with your work product, right? That will be great. How fortunate, right, for a white attorney to be under those circumstances. How unfortunate, right, for a black attorney. Because while you can have a phenomenal career as an attorney and never become a partner, we're talking about people who have the same work product, who have the same ability to actually be partners. This is just a matter of interpretation of the work product based on who they think they are. And the difference between partner and not partner could be $11 million over your career, right? After tax, this is a massive, substantial amount. You have to think about what that means for that family, what that means for that community, what that means to the church that they may be a part of, what that means to the nonprofit boards that they may sit on, and so on and so forth. That cost reverberates throughout the community. And that's the point that I'm trying to make here, which is that there is a significant financial cost to Black people based on discrimination, and it has a massive intergenerational effect.
And, you know, Elliot, that's why your question, you know, raising the point about the historical roots of it is so important.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I don't think you continue to, you know, ask how that has played out over time.
Yeah, Mr. Rochester, when you talked about the ending of chattel enslavement, because according to the 13th Amendment, slavery has never really ended. And then the moving into Jim Crow. Let me go back to the period after the Civil War, because according to the numbers that you gave, I think you said 20 million people was employed worldwide.
Yep.
It was a global industry, but our people here was not employed. They were forced slave labor. So now let's look at it, because I seen a video of you addressing a college, I don't know what college it was, but you said in order to deal with this, you have to have empathy and understanding for the people that were wronged. If that is the case, according to the numbers, even with the 40 acres and a mule that never got to our ancestors, even if they Europeans had given that to our ancestors, it really didn't even total. It didn't match up what I'm saying. It didn't reflect the work that was done for over 250 years. And plus, balancing that, the amount of land that they had given to Caucasians that had came over in the Homestead Act.
Mm-hmm.
So it was never really any type of real justice that was going to be done during that period. I just want to reinforce that, because a lot of our people talk about their 40 acres and a mule. But even if we had gotten it, that would have still fell very much short of any justice to our ancestors.
Yeah, the 40 acres and a mule would have represented startup resources, right? Significant startup resources, because you would have the land that you could subsist off of, and then you could sell the excess, right, into the market. You have the mule, right, which is really like the equivalent of a tractor.
Okay.
Because I normally set the mule aside, right, and I don't really talk very much about the mule. But if you think of it in terms of the equivalent of a tractor, right, the average tractor is $50,000, right, times 4 million people is $200 billion, right? It's no small amount. It augments the labor of the individual, right? But here's the other thing that we have to juxtapose with that, which is that a massive portion of the artisans, the craftspeople, were the enslaved. Like, what people need to understand is, like, the population has the skill set to actually build towns and communities and schools, because they were the ones who had to do it when their labor was completely owned by white people.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's important. It certainly would not have been enough, but it would or commensurate with what was taken from them. But it would have been an extraordinary investment in them getting a start. And they didn't get anything.
Now, the other part to that I wanted you to kind of throw some light on, although you did already, is the part of the Jim Crow system being started up right after Reconstruction. It's clear to me And I want you to explain it because you've seen the numbers. It's clear to me from the case that you've laid out that being that it was so much trillions of dollars already invested and an investment that the United States had because they basically controlled the world market, that they needed that labor that all of a sudden wasn't on those plantations anymore being forced to work. They needed them back on those plantations somehow. So it was an agreement between both Democrats and Republicans at that time to allow the system of Jim Crow to come into effect, which was almost 100 years of a similar system that we had lived under. And you drew a parallel, and I want you to kind of flesh that out for our people listening on the radio. You drew a parallel, and correct me if I'm wrong, that in some cases the Jim Crow system was worse or just as bad as chattel enslavement because you gave different areas on how. Well, you go ahead and explain it, Mr. Rochester.
Yeah, so the thing that where I specifically speak about is the convict leasing aspect of it.
Okay.
Right? So you've got a massive global cotton famine, right? Because you cut off the supply. See, you have to remember that oil is cotton is the first truly global industry, right? It's the equivalent of like what oil is today. So you created this thing called this cotton famine. The South is devastated and they need abundant cheap labor, right? And there's a worldwide demand for this. And how do you get that? And so they have to create a structure that's going to allow for it. Now, the Jim Crow system is underpinned by sharecropping, right? And sharecropping is literally an employment contract, right? Between newly free people and their descendants and like small white farmers. What happened is those large mega plantations were broken into smaller lots, right? And black families would agree to settle on those lots and they would plant cash crops. And at the end of the harvest, they would bring the crops to market and then they would share in a portion of the crop. And that's literally where the term sharecropping comes from, right? But the problem is that it's a contract and it's a labor contract and all the terms and conditions have been set by the white farmer. The other issue is these people left slavery with no economic resources and the harvest doesn't come tomorrow. It comes at the end of the season or year, right? And between now and then, that white farmer has to provide you with the clothes, with food, with shelter, with the tools, with the fertilizer, with all the resources that you need to be able to get to harvest. And he's providing those resources to you at rates up to 70% per year. So in effect, he's controlling all of your cost structure, all your expenses, right? Now, the other thing that we have to understand is that, when you go to market, or when you take the crops to market, the white farmer is the market, tells you what they're worth. So you've got an individual that controls your cost structure. You got an individual that also controls your revenue, your income, which by definition means that they control your profit, right? That you can easily see if that's the case, that profit's going to either be zero or negative, which is why by definition, that can be 100% tax on your labor, which means you're back into a form of slavery. Now, if you don't like it and you don't want to sign the contract and participate in this, well, they have laws for that. And those laws are called vagrancy laws. And they say quite simply that if you can't prove you're a landowner or gainfully employed, that they can charge you with a criminal offense and put you in a state or county jail. Mm-hmm. Right? Now you say, all right, I didn't see that coming. I'll sign a contract, but maybe I rethink it. I don't want to do it because it's a bad deal, you know? But now if you break that contract, there's some laws for that called contract enforcement laws, which is you broke that labor contract, so they could charge you a criminal offense and put you in a state or county jail, right? Now, if you say, well, I'm just going to sit in jail and you'll feed me 3 square meals a day until you get tired and let me out, what they will hit you with is something called convict leasing, which means that they will lease you back out to the same small white farmer or private corporation that you didn't want to work for in the first place, right? And under convict leasing, you have up to, the mortality rate is almost up to 50%. You have a 1 in 2 chance of death. This is why convict leasing, you can argue in one respect, is you could argue is even worse than slavery. Because in slavery, while a slave owner will kill you and beat you within an inch of your life, you know, slaves or people held in bondage are expensive. And they would much rather have you around for another 5 or 10 or 15 years to maximize the return on their investment. In convict leasing, that is called the interest in your residual value, your value in the future, right? In convict leasing, they have no interest in your value in the future. They have no interest whatsoever in your residual value. They only care about you for the period of time that you're with them, whether it's 8 months or 16 months. That's it. Your life beyond that, they don't care about. So you got mortality rates approaching 50%. So you got a 1 in 2 chance of death, right? But it's extremely profitable. To the point where, I think it's in 1914, that 20% of the revenues for the state of Alabama is coming from convict leasing alone, and there are people who have estimates that are higher than that, right? So it's draconian. There's no way out, right? During that period of time, that's where you have 4,000 black people being lynched, publicly executed by their fellow Americans. Right, there is no recourse that you have under those circumstances, and it's extraordinarily difficult to accumulate wealth because they control your revenue, and they control your expenses.
And you know, if I may, because I wanted to continue that period, but it seemed that something was taking place as far as black people were still able to with that reality and the numbers to that reality being there. And I just wanted to see, because I wanted you to develop the piece of what happened to black teachers in that period after Reconstruction, because I think that that's important. And I'm sorry, y'all, I'm stuck on stupid on this here, implicit and explicit bias, right? But from what I understand, between 1867 and 1917, there was 4,000 black-owned businesses that grew to 50,000, and by 1930, to 70,000 black-owned businesses. So even with these draconian structures put in place, black people leaving out of chattel enslavement were still able to work a economic development system of their own. And because I'm dealing with this bias, and it has something to do with beliefs, I believe, can you develop what the teaching profession, the black teaching profession, and what happened to that during the Jim Crow period and moving further? Because I think that I want to make the argument that has something to do with black people's aspiration or buying into these biases, and the what it costs in losing that black teacher profession, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, you know, when you have the period of Jim Crow, right, going from about 1870 or so up until, you know, about, you know, 1945, black teachers are experiencing extraordinary levels of economic discrimination, right? In many instances, they're making 25 to 34 cents on the dollar for what a white teacher would be making teaching the same subjects. And on average, black teachers were higher qualified, right? They had higher and more advanced degrees than their white peers. Now, when you start to get into Brown v. Board of Education, which is in 1954, right, when that happens, this is about correcting the separate but equal and leading into this integration. At that time, you have about 82,000 black teachers teaching about 2+ million black students, right? And I always had the question of whatever happens to all the black teachers, because at what point, you know, by law, you know, black students had black teachers,
mm-hmm.
right? And in the 11 years following Brown v. Board of Education, 40,000 of the 82,000 black teachers were systematically eliminated, fired, right? Across the South and bordering states. And 90% of black male administrators, principals, were eliminated. Now, what you have to understand is that, you know, to be a teacher or educator in a black community was an enormously big deal. It was one of the few professions that highly educated people could go into, right? They represented roughly 50% of, you know, the black, you know, upper and middle class, right? And over a 10-year period, 11-year period, you know, you had half of those people, which was a quarter of that, of the black upper middle class, was wiped out systematically. And it wasn't like they were going to go from teaching into sales or HR or, you know, procurement or head of research and development. You could not have those positions at the time, right? And if you look at the history of many just extremely impressive people within our community that are doing great things, they typically come from a lineage of people in their family who were educators.
Right.
Right? It was completely and enormously devastating. And those black teachers were replaced with white teachers.
You know, wait a minute, Mr. Rochester. I want to go back because I want the listening audience to understand that the 54 decision, Brown versus Board of Education, was separate but unequal. So when it was defeated or struck down, that allowed, because before that, just like you stated, black teachers were teaching in black schools.
Mm-hmm.
And white teachers, by and large, were teaching in white schools to white students.
Yep.
So when that law was struck off the books, and thousands of black teachers and administrators lost their jobs, that law that was supposed to help you basically helped white folks, because that not only allowed them to teach in their schools, but it allowed them to take your jobs and teach in your schools. Is that what you're saying?
What we have to do is deal with what is the logical ramification of a particular action that's taken.
Okay.
Right? So I believe it's 1898 where it was separate but equal was put in place.
Right.
Right? The idea was equal. And equal was supposed to mean equal resources and equal infrastructure and equal opportunity. There was nothing equal about it in mm-hmm. any way, shape, or form. Not the school, not the resources, not the buildings. You had problems with roofing and HVAC and resources and lab equipment and books and everything, right? You had a massive underinvestment in the human capital development of black people in this country through a legal mechanism that was supposed to be equal. The issue that was brought to the Supreme Court was about getting equal resources. It was not about integration.
There you go.
Right? It was okay. about getting equal resources. And what they came to the conclusion of is the best way to get the equal resources was to integrate the people. But what is short-sighted is how do you integrate into people who have massive levels of vitriol against one group?
Right.
For hundreds of years, and it was never addressed. Right. So now you have this forcing function of people who don't want another group. There's whole school districts that were shut down for a whole year. Right. You have to have federal troops in there and state troopers escorting, you know, young children into school districts and protesting and anger and vitriol. You had all this stuff happening at the same time. So if you're being integrated into an administration that's run by people who have not implicit unconscious bias, but vitriolic, explicit bias, they know exactly what they're doing, how long do you think you're going to be there? Right? Then that was the problem. Now, that was the logical conclusion of actually doing that. You may have the right desire and the right intent, but you're not looking at the environment in which this is playing out. and you're actually not putting the structures around to get the outcome that you would want, right? And that's what happened. The idea of what were they thinking behind the door, I can't say, but logically, you know that if you're going to integrate a group of people who are viewed, right, and as not fully American and not fully capable, right? And there was a time where people were having, this is in the early 1900s, where people are having questions about, you know, is it even socially acceptable to be in the same places as Black people? And to what extent do you know, Black people even have souls? I mean, they had Black people on display at what is now the Bronx Zoo, right? A Black man, right? Sitting there with orangutans and whatnot in 1906, 40,000 New Yorkers showing up to watch this, right? And not protest it, right? But to watch it. So these issues never were really dealt with and resolved. So when you try to integrate people into a group that doesn't want them, what's going to happen? You're going to have a negative response, and then you're going to have a movement. You're going to have, that's where you start to see white flight. And that's where you start to see in the South, people created their own private schools, right? And you had a proliferation of those schools that started up because people wanted to maintain the same amount of segregation that they had before.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. And you can get involved, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Our guest is author, financial educator, and CEO of Good Shepherd LLC, Sean D. Rochester. The Black Tax, the cost of being Black in America, is the subject. And we'll be right back.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072, spelled new as in numerous, on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
I did a study in 1960. And then 1960, we had approximately 103 black elected officials in the entire United States. I did a social discomfort indicator study to find out what the conditions were of black folk were in 1960. I looked at the unemployment rate, the dysfunctional schools, dysfunctional family, joblessness, unemployment, income, everything, median family income. Then I waited 30 years until 1990 and did the exact same study to see what had happened. Why? Because in 1990, 30 years later, black folks' number of representatives in elected office has gone up over 9,000%. I say if black folk have gone from 103 elected officials to 9,000, boy, we must be doing well in the country. I did the same exact study, discomfort indicator study, and found out that not only didn't black folks progress, guess what? They went backwards. They went backwards because there's no connection between putting a black person in office and getting benefits. None of them are going to do it. As soon as a black person gets elected to office, the first thing they're going to do is violate the sworn oath he just took. He'll swear it over and say, I'm sworn to get in the office to represent those people who elected me to office and serve them. As soon as a black person gets to office, first thing I say is that I'm here to take care of everybody.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and we're in conversation with our guest this evening, author, financial educator, and CEO of Good Shepherd LLC, Mr. Sean Rochester. The book, The Black Tax, The Cost of Being Black in America. You can join the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Newport News. Newport News.
Hello, gentlemen. Good evening.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Rochester, I'm going to try to get straight to the point because I'm really impressed with your whole presentation. When you started talking about the teachers losing their jobs, I got involved with this as a high school student here in York County, Virginia. When you start talking about the teachers that lost their job, what I ended up finding out, and I studied a little bit, but I'm no expert, not only did they replace the black teachers with white teachers, but the majority of the South did something else. The cost of public education went up, and they provided almost 30, from what I could figure out, guessing, 35 to 40% of the teachers that they used to replace the blacks actually were teaching with provisional teaching certificates while being given an incentive to complete their education. Particularly here in Virginia, they use West Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky as the main resource for those teachers. I found that out by going through old records here in York County. And I want to put one other thing out and then let you go. You also talked about the impact of cotton. I don't hear many people talk about the fact it wasn't just the American economy that tanked because you were talking about the 60% of production of cotton that was supporting the world market. It was actually one of the first times there was a global economic downturn because of the Civil War. And the third thing also associated with that was U.S. steel and railroad expansion, because they used that convict leasing for not only the mining, but also laying most of the tracks that went north and south in this continent. Thank you.
Thank you for that information there, Brother Otis. Mr. Rochester?
Yeah, no, he is exactly right. There was a global cotton famine. It was a global reverberation in the marketplace. It affected the entire world. Right. And there is no doubt that black people who were convict lease worked for private corporations, including ones that he mentioned, to provide labor for the construction of railroads and other things. There is no doubt. And of course, you know, the information on replacing black teachers with what sounds like, you know, underqualified teachers with a promise to get qualifications later is not surprising at all to me.
And before you go to the next call, Elliot, because something that came up in the clip that you played with Dr. Anderson, and something that I heard you mention, Mr. Rochester, in a talk, and that was in the question of defining the language. And specifically, you develop, and I would like you to develop for the audience, the reason why we have to be clearly specific compared to, say, terms that come out about minority when we're talking about economic, utilizing economic advantage in to our best interest. You developed that that it's important to understand what that means from a economic, I mean, from a actual, yes, an economic or black tax perspective. Why is minority too general a term as it relates to us?
Yeah, so thank you for raising that question, right? Because I think it's important that we are specific and that we are clear. The terms like minority, diversity, inclusion tend to be euphemisms for not white male, right? And if you look at planet Earth and you get into this category of not white male, it's about 90% of people, of humans in the world. It's a massive category, right? Now, the example that I always give that I think is very important for us to take a look at. So if you look at, the P in PhD is about, how we spend as individuals and how corporations, governments, and institutions spend through their supply chain, right? And if you look at supply chain spending and you look at businesses that have employees, right? That's a very special and unique category of businesses. Within Black businesses, only 4% of Black businesses actually have any employees. And that 4% generates roughly about 70% of the total revenue, about $100 billion, employs about 1 million people. So if we take a look, right, at, let's say we say, you know what, we want to do more business with women-owned businesses with employees, right? I think that's fantastic, phenomenal, double, triple, quadruple down on that. But if you ask yourself the question of women-owned businesses that have employees, how much revenue do they drive? The answer is they drive about $1.2 trillion of revenue, significant. But if you ask how much of that is attributed to Black women-owned business, it's 2%. And what that means is it's not until the $99 when you're investing in women that a Black woman entrepreneur is going to see a dollar. And I'm interested in what's happening with Black women within that group, right? If we say to ourselves, let's invest and do more business with our Latino brothers and sisters, businesses that have employees, I think that's phenomenal. Double, triple down on that. But if we look at how much revenue is associated with those businesses, it's roughly about $380 billion or so on an annual basis, right? But if you say how many of those are Black people within that group or Afro-Latino, it's 2%. Again, it's not until the $99 when you're investing in a category that a Black person within it. And if you ask yourself the question about, our Asian brothers and sisters, their revenue generation for businesses with employees is approaching $700 billion. And by definition, there aren't Black people in that group, right? So if you add up the entire group, which would be non-white male, right, diverse, inclusive, so on and so forth, only 4% of the revenue of that entire group is Black firms. And that means 96% of it is not, right? So you have to be specific, because what you can do is put policies and programs in place that can be enormously effective for increasing economic opportunities for diverse and inclusive and whatever euphemism you want to use, businesses, and can have little to no impact on Black business. If you want to affect Black business, you have to be a specific. You actually have to develop policies and plans and programs that are specific to be stimulative to driving economic opportunities for Black business. One of the reasons for that is because you have high levels of anti-Black bias. All of these groups face bias, but their bias is less intense, and it decreases at a lower rate on their bias decreases at a faster rate than bias against Black businesses. Bias against Black businesses is very resistant, right, to change on average. So you have to be specific. And Black businesses have the least economic resources and financial and economic infrastructure to help position them well. So that's why we have to be very, very careful. You have people who really do have good intentions, but they don't understand the numbers, right, or the detail on the numbers, because they rarely report on the Black portion of those categories. They tell you how the category is doing. A category can do immensely well, and that's a wonderful thing for all those people. God bless them. But when you look at what's happening with Black businesses, it tends to be 1%, and it's not changing very much, right? So we need to be specific. And why is it important? It's important because when you do business with Black enterprise, it stimulates the demand for products and services, which requires incremental jobs. And those jobs affect families, and those families affect communities, right? It's great for the country. And we have to be specific, because if you're not specific, it's not going to have the desired impact.
And because, you know, really important when we're, especially now we're in this here national political discussion, because government provides a great stimulus to could provide like a great stimulus in that supply chain, in that purchasing power to Black businesses. And it seems that it's up to us as, you know, a Black constituent, Black voters, Black citizens, to really be vigilant about that, because it's about our economic survival. You know, I don't mean to be on a soapbox, but it's just, Elliot, we talk about this all the time in relationship to, you know, the politics of this, but we can't, because of this bias, we cannot allow the politicians or the bureaucracy, individuals in these bureaucracies, because of, and let's say that it is implicit bias. You know, they don't really mean it, but when it comes down to it, we get harmed by it. So it seems it behooves us to be the ones that are the ones who are the watchdogs and make sure, and as you say, Mr. Rochester, make sure even the language is correct and when what we're looking at or requesting the studies. I thought that was important and point that you brought up about that, because we get thrown this minority piece all the time.
Yeah, and thank you for making that point. We have to be specific. The problem is we've been socialized to not be specific. Mm-hmm. And we're actually penalized when we are, right? So people have, adjusted to that. But if you are not specific, it's enormously dilutive, right? Because we believe that the resources are going to flow equitably. They do not. Your ability to accumulate wealth is directly proportional to the amount of bias that your in-group faces. And Black people face the highest level of bias from every single group.
Let's go to 314 in St. Louis. Question or comment for our guest?
Yeah, good evening, brothers. Brother Elliot, Brother Richard, Dr. Rochester. This is Yah Ami calling from St. Louis, Missouri. How y'all doing tonight?
How are you, sir?
Good.
We're doing good, brother. I just wanted to say I appreciate what you guys are doing, and Dr. Rochester, I appreciate the information that you have provided to our people tonight. It's very informative, and it reminds me of a situation where you had a group of Caucasians that went to Africa trying to figure out how to get Africans to buy their products. Well, this group of individuals, these Caucasians, they had a box of shoes, and they were wandering around. They were wondering why all the Black folk did not have shoes. So they brought this box of shoes over there, and they're trying to sell these shoes to the Black folk in Africa, and they would not buy the shoes. So he went back to Europe or wherever they were, the group of people, and they consulted with their businessmen. And they said, okay, well, take this box back over there. This time, fill it with tax and guarantee they'll buy the shoes. So he says, okay. So this group of Caucasians, they went back to Africa, and they threw the contents of that box of tax on the ground. And the Africans, according to this story, they began to buy the shoes because their feet were sore, they were bleeding, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so this group of Caucasians came back to Europe or wherever they were, and they said that it worked. And they made all this money off of these people. Long story short, the tax on us today is ignorance. right? And so we are ignorant to the fact of some of the stuff that you said tonight, Brother Elliot, Brother Richard, what you guys were identifying. It's important and imperative that we educate ourselves, right? And when you mentioned the fact about the 40 acres and a mule, and then the trillions of dollars that is currently owed to us, right, or would have been owed to our ancestors, the equivalent of $97 trillion. I mean, that's a phenomenal number, right? And so I think that if we really look at that and evaluate that and stop asking for the reparations of 40 acres and a mule, when in fact we should be asking for a lot more than that. So I just wanted to say again, thank you for enlightening us on that phenomenal on the information that you provided. So with that, I digress. Thank you, brothers.
Thank you for your call, bro.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
If I can, Elliot, you know, Mr. Rochester, you got my vote, right?
I didn't know you was running for office.
The contextual framework, and again, you hear me harping on this here, implicit and explicit bias, because one thing that you also raised that we have to be conscientious about is that our own internal implicit and explicit bias as it relates to supporting Black businesses or supporting ourselves. So can you develop that again, and how that fits into, and I don't know how to say this word, mnemonic, the PhD, you know, you mentioned about purchasing, and then it's the H&D.
Yeah, so the bias levels that I was talking about here with you tonight and in the book are bias levels held by Americans. They are also bias levels held by Black people. So there's actually two Black taxes. There's an external Black tax that's imposed upon us from people outside of the group. But then there's an internal Black tax that we impose on ourselves because we have the same anti-Black bias as others do. Where our bias tends to show up and rear its head is typically in commerce, which is us not doing business together, which is why I stress this PhD economic framework, because it's stimulative to job creation, right? And business development and providing, you know, capital. It is of you know, vital and utmost importance. We all know that as entrepreneurs of the negative views that we have about our own businesses. So we are allocating resources to other businesses and other communities that are very stimulative. It's creating jobs there. What a lot of people don't know is that, you know, Black spending is creating upwards of 22 million jobs across the U.S., primary, secondary, and tertiary levels, right? We actually have a very important role to play in the community because we're very, very high consumption people. The challenge is that most of those jobs are created outside of our communities. And that would be okay if people actually did business with our businesses and had a correspondingly positive stimulative effect within our community. And they don't. What PhD says is when possible, where possible, use high quality Black talent and products. I'll give you a couple of examples as individuals, what we can do. Very often, you know, people will kind of razzle dazzle you with the house that they bought if they're so blessed to be able to do something like that, right? And that's great. And that's wonderful. My question is, did you use a Black realtor? Right? My question is, unless you bought the house cash and you want to roll dice, you got to have insurance on it, right? And did you use a Black insurer or Black broker, right? You bought the house, maybe it's not to your standards and you want to fix it up. You want to fix up the basement or the kitchen or bathrooms or whatever. Do you use a Black contractor? Do you use Black plumbers? And look, these are super high quality jobs that will never leave the country. And all too often, the answer is no, because while we have $1.2 trillion of income, which we all hear that number, only about 2% of that spending is with Black enterprise. 98% is with everyone else. So we're very stimulative for other communities, but not for our own. And to me, the PhD is a framework that specifically stimulates jobs and businesses and capital in the Black community, but it's for everyone to do, right? If people believe deeply about economic advancement, the way they should do it is by doing business with us. Put your resources in our banks and our financial institutions. Buy your car from a Black dealer, right? The average dealer has 66 employees. Have you ever left the car dealership and been happy about the bill that you've gotten, right? These are great paying jobs from the front to the mechanics to the service people. These are phenomenal jobs. There are, I believe, 16,000 dealers across the country. I believe the number is 264 of them are Black, right? And as a people, we're buying 5 million cars a year. If we did business with our auto dealers, you would have closer to 2,000 auto dealers, right? And just do that quick math on 66 people on average working there. It will be massively stimulative, but we go buy our fancy cars from other people that have poor representation of us. Whether it's conscious or unconscious, I'm not picking a lane. I'm just looking at the impact of it, mm-hmm. right? Those are things that we can do on our own volition that we don't need permission from anyone to do that, not Congress, not anybody. We could do that now. We could do it tomorrow, right? We need to let our institutions know that we value PhD. It's good for our community. It's good for our families. It's good for America. There's nothing bad about jobs, businesses, and providing capital. It's a wonderfully foundational thing that we need to have. So you let your university know that in addition to having great representation of Black students and Black professors, behind every professor is 10 to 15 employees. Who's speaking about that representation? These universities are billion-dollar procurers of resources. Are they doing business with our businesses? Right?
Know.
Typically, the answer is no. For your politician, it's like, hey, I want to vote for you. I want you to be successful. I want you to be happy. What's your plan for PhD? What's your plan for jobs, business, and capital in Black community specifically? What's your plan for that? You ain't got a plan? We'll help you work on a plan. Help me help you, right? But you're not going to get massive value from me without a return in value back to me, right? The law of our market says you don't respect people who do stuff like that.
No,
right?
Yes.
And you will be exploited to the maximum amount acceptable. So I think this framework of PhD is a requirement because it creates jobs and businesses. Whenever possible, you can't always do it because the resources may not be there. They may not be in your locale, but whenever possible, wherever possible, do it. Then the other thing is start making sure that the people who are leading us and speaking on our behalf actually interface with Black business or Black enterprise in some way. Right. It astounds me that people who don't do any business whatsoever, but they're speaking about economic advancement for Black people and the future for us. And they don't have one policy on a job being created, businesses being developed. You know, we're not interested in these kind of life support resources. Right. We don't just want to survive. We want to thrive. And to do that, we need jobs, business and capital. And oh, by the way, it's great for everyone.
It's amazing that, you know, over time it's been said how the growth and development of Black people in America is great for everyone. But in spite of that, the choices that are, and you're raising the internal choices and the external choices of individuals in these positions seem not to do that. But, you know, one thing, another thing I wanted to, you know, and you raising this because that struck me in the discussion about banks and therefore, i.e. deposits. And the reason why this seems to be important, because I want to always tie it back to our politics. Yeah. Something I seen where Hamilton said that a strong bank is a wealth creator, but it requires government in order to be a stabilizing wealth creator, a central government. So it requires us as citizens, Black citizens, to be pushing our politicians, as you say, and policy and whatever, to make these deposits. I mean, these universities, these colleges and these other entities that the government put in place, I don't see them saying they are making deposits in Black banks. which can be a stimulus. How does Black banks become a stimulus in Black and as a wealth creator in Black communities?
So there's a lot of things here, right? We got to start with the understanding that the information that I'm talking about, it's not in our curriculum, right?
Yes.
So white folks on average live in communities with far more wealth than we do, far, far, far more, right? But the curriculum is basically the same. And this information is not in it. So the conclusions that they come to is based on what they are seeing and what they are being told. And what they're seeing and being told is very concentrated and very homogenous and very negative about Black folks. So in those circumstances, it's very easy to come to their conclusions and to feel justified, right? And part of what I want to do was to help people see things differently. You cannot present problems to people who don't, or solutions to people who don't see the problem or don't see it the way you do, right? So we first have to get people to see and understand like where they're coming from. They may not, they don't know about the financial implications of slavery, right? They don't know the quantification of Jim Crow. They don't know that Black teachers were absolutely devastated. It looks like we abdicate our responsibility to teach our people because we're not there. They don't know all that kind of stuff. So we have to provide some information so they can have some context and some understanding, and that generally leads to empathy. I'm not trying to convert everybody, but there are people for whom this information matters. Let's kind of talk to them. Because once you provide them with it, you have this next step, which is people start to say, well, what can we do? And that's where you want to be, because now that's where the real hard work stands, starts, right? Because then you say, okay, the things, the policies, programs, and things we put in place have to represent and reflect PhD. That's going to be the barometer by which we measure the effectiveness or the efficacy of a program or policy. Is it creating jobs, businesses? Are we providing capital within the Black community? You have to have a strong financial infrastructure. If a family doesn't have a strong financial core, you can have great desires, but your outcomes are going to be extraordinarily limited, right? Black banks are necessary because of the historically high discriminatory lending practices and other resource distribution practices within the U.S. financial systems, right? But our banks are undercapitalized when it comes to deposits, and they are undercapitalized when it comes to the actual money that they need to invest in their resources and in their teams and in their infrastructure and systems and so on and so forth, right? We got to do both at the same time. And very often, you know, everybody wants to live in Black Wall Street, but before you live there, you actually got to build it, right? Like somebody's got to sacrifice. Somebody's got to buy the land. You will read the history, right? Someone bought the land and cut it up into parcels and sold it to Black people who hadn't had any other choice and options. And it grew to be something amazing over time. But we've got to invest in it as opposed to waiting for somebody to build it and hand it to us.
Let's go to 215. 215, question or comment for our guest?
Hey, good evening, Brother Elliot. How you doing?
How are you, sir?
But hey, Brother Richard.
And
good evening, Dr. Rochester. How you doing?
I am wonderful. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. All praises be to Allah. You know, Dr. Rochester, I'm sitting here listening tonight, and like Brother Otis in the previous call, about the information, because I'm sitting here and just taking all in what you're saying, because when you mentioned to Brother Elliot and Brother Richard about how you used the example of the law firm, you said the difference between being a partner and an associate, especially for a Black man or anyone else, could be, you know, somewhere in over a lifetime, somewhere in the vicinity of $11 million. And to me, Dr. Rochester, they just pointed out how, again, Black people are always getting the short end of the stick, because I got some friends of mine, some of them deceased, some of them still living, that was veterans. And, you know, they was talking about how, you know, when they came out of the service back in the 1950s, whatever like that, and they was on the GI Bill, they said how some of their white fellow GIs was able to take the GI Bill and partner that into getting houses. And in other words, Dr. Rochester, they used the GI Bill as part one of their wealth building process. Whereas the Black GIs who fought in the same war and served this country, they've got the short end of the stick with their GI Bill. They were discriminated against, you know? And this is something that's not talked about a whole lot, as you know, Dr. Rochester, because a good friend of mine who's deceased, he said it bothered him to the day he passed away. In 16, he said how he served this country, and he said he wasn't able to, like one of his white friends who was, he served in the same conflict with, he said his white friend was able to go and go move to Levittown here in Pennsylvania and stuff like that. Because of him being a black man, he wasn't even allowed in Levittown, you know what I mean, because of the racist, the Bill Levitt, who was the creator of Levittown up here in Bucks County, PA. So, I mean, there's just more and more. This is one example, Dr. Rochester, of the discrimination that black people face with again, the GI Bill is a prime one. And an example used with the lawyer being a partner as opposed to being an associate. I mean, them good examples, Dr. Rochester. And right here in Philadelphia, if you get a chance, it's an article by a prominent black lawyer in the Philadelphia Tribune, which is the oldest black paper in the country, where his lawyer wrote about how black people, how we finance our own oppression, how we, as a people, we support white-owned businesses a lot of times who have a history of discriminatory practice against us, and we keep on going to these people over and over again, and yet they being racist, in a lot of cases, vile towards us in terms of not only being racist, but calling the police on us, have you followed around the store like you a criminal, things like that, because the great Reverend Leon Sullivan, who was an ancestor. Now he's the creator of OIC here in Philadelphia. He helped create the first major black shopping mall here in Philadelphia back in 1968, called Progress Plaza, down there by Tubman University. But Reverend Sullivan's motto was always, "Don't shop where you can't work, and don't shop where they can't, you know, where they don't respect you." Right? That was his whole motto back then, you know. So I just want to say, Dr. Rochester, I thank you for coming up with the information, because I'm learning a lot tonight. And what you're doing is valuable. And I think somebody like yourself, and I thank Brother Elliott and Brother Richard for having you on, you should be featured on TV shows and radio shows around the country, because a lot of our people, ignorance is the main, they don't know about things. Not that they dumb, they just don't know about the things that you're saying, Dr. Rochester. I think what you're saying is valuable, and our people need to hear that, whether they be on a college campus or whether they're on a 9-to-5 job or whether whatever profession they're in, they need to hear what you're saying and get your book, because I'm going to get your book, because it's valuable, Dr. Rochester. I can't put emphasis on it enough. What you're saying is just, it's like we need to be bottled up, because it's valuable information. And I thank Brother Ellen Richard for having you on, and I thank you for letting me better, you know, talk to you tonight, and keep up the good work, Dr. Rochester.
Thank you so much, brother. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Let's try to get one more, squeeze one more in before we let Dr. Rochester go. Let's go to 215 again. 215. Uh-oh, I better listen.
It's
getting hollered at or something going on. Maybe his wife is on his back. I don't know. Dr. Rochester, you know, our caller just raised an issue in reference to the GI Bill,
yep,
and housing, and
yep.
In brief, before we let you go, talk about how that has influenced the black tax, so to speak, because we know about redlining and things like that, but that GI Bill and that New Deal really put distance between European families and black families. Talk about that from your perspective and the numbers.
Absolutely. And let me just say, your audience is being amazing and incredibly generous. I do not have a PhD, so it's just Mr. Rochester or just Sean, right?
you know how black folks do. I shouldn't say that. Go ahead.
I appreciate it. So let's talk a little bit about the GI Bill. And let's kind of start with the end first, right? And we can work our way back. If you look at the equivalent of the resources, the size of the resources that were denied to black soldiers, and you had 1 million black soldiers fought in World War II, right? It's approaching $45 billion. These are the resources that our soldiers did not get, because less than 2% of the economic resources from the GI Bill went to black soldiers, right? Now, what did the GI Bill do? The GI Bill provided economic resources so that you could have these soldiers that were coming back, and I think it was close to 16 million soldiers that were coming back, the opportunity to get a tertiary education, to go to university, right? That it was invested so that they could get job training, right, to be able to take on, you know, higher skilled jobs. It was money that was, you know, invested so that they could buy homes, right, subsidized by the government. Now, the challenge, right, with these things is those resources were diverted away from black soldiers. And you also have to remember that in those days, you still had segregation. So you had Black soldiers who were couldn't go to all the universities in the North in the numbers, right? And they're just limited to the HBCUs that are in the South. But the HBCUs did not have enough seats to even handle that number of soldiers that were coming back, right? So it is without question that that those soldiers were not given those economic resources to develop their skill set to be able to buy the homes, right? And we're talking of upwards of over $40 billion, right? So it's a non-trivial expense. I'll just give you like a quick anecdote. I was having a conversation, you know, at a church with a group of elders at the church. And one of them, his father fought in World War II. And his father would recall this story about how he would go from office to office trying to get benefits from the GI Bill. He would get denied every time, right? And he went this final time, and as he was denied and as he was leaving, you know, the white person at the office said, what? It was either platoon or company, did you say you were with again? And the guy and his father said the name of the platoon. He said, wow, you guys saved our lives, right? So come on back. And the guy, he came on back, and the guy filled out his paperwork, and he got it. But what I want you to understand is this soldier had to be in a position where his company saved the life of the individual to get the resources that he should have gotten by law.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, this is incredibly painful to individuals. But we're talking about a massive economic impact. And that's what people need to understand. It happens, and not only does it happen and has happened, but it has a massive economic impact. And wealth is temporal. It goes through time, right? If you affect the wealth of a family now, you're going to affect the wealth of generations to come, right? And if it's affecting me and mine, you and yours, and us and ours in an economic way, that's something that we have to address. And people have to understand that the position that we're in now, which is owning less about 2% of U.S. wealth, is not because of a series of disastrous decisions that Black people in this country have made, right? This was an environment that was imposed upon them that naturally creates these negative outcomes.
You know, me and Richard was talking before the show this evening, Mr. Rochester, about some of the things that have been in the news lately, and talked about the, and I'm quite sure you probably saw the article that appeared in published reports, I guess it was about 2 weeks ago, in reference to Starbucks and how their white employees across the board was paid more than Black employees doing similar jobs at Starbucks. So these things that you're talking about, even though you put an historical context to it, they haven't ended. Some of them have morphed into other things where it's almost like a clandestine type of thing where you can't see it, but it's still here. It's still very much a part of the society we live in.
Absolutely. It's just another manifest. They're being black taxed, right? And what you have to remember is we don't know if that's explicit or implicit. And I don't take a position. I'm not really interested in the mode that it's coming from, just the impact.
Okay.
So same work product, but you're getting paid less. That's an economic impact on your family and your ability to cover resources today and have something left over to provide for the future, right? And those are things that need to be addressed. Those are things that are clearly wrong and inappropriate, but it's not tolerable. And I'm not saying that people mean to do it, but the outcome is definitive, and we need to be able to change, you know, those outcomes. And they can do statistical analysis to see what these gaps are, right? Like these things are addressable, you know? I'll give you an example with the Starbucks. You know, they, when you had that arrest of the Black sales gentlemen who were having a meeting at Starbucks, remember this?
Mm-hmm. And then, right? That was here in Philadelphia.
The police, mm-hmm. This insane reaction to it, right? That's anti-Black bias, right? You know, Starbucks took it really seriously, right? Relative to other firms, they kind of shut down for half a day, and they did some like racial bias training and stuff like that, right? My thing, let me tell you what the power of PhD is, right? I think that's great because they did more than what other people do, which is ignore it or brush it away and stuff like that. PhD says if you want to affect change, and they said that they want to affect change and do a good job to help folks, and we take them at their word, then I say, okay, that's fantastic. What are you doing, right, to increase Black representation at the corporate office, right? What are you doing to increase Black representation within the franchise infrastructure, right? And providing capital so you have more franchisees because that stimulates employment. What are you doing to do more business in your supply chain? You got to buy a bunch of different products and services. You know, are you buying products and services from Black firms and are you doing it in representative ways? Because that can have an enormous stimulative impact. Decisions like that can create 10,000 jobs in our communities. Right. And they don't have that framework. I'm not blaming them. They don't know anything about PhD. Right. But if you want to have real impact in terms of jobs, business and capital, that's what you need to be doing and thinking. And we need to make sure everyone is aware that that matters to us and we want it to matter to them. And we're happy to do business with them. But we need to see the PhD. It's good for us. It's good for them. It's good for the country.
Mr. Rochester, before we let you go, give out any information where the folks can get the book, how they can reach you, or things of that nature. The floor is yours.
So the book is called The Black Tax, The Cost of Being Black in America. You can get it on our website, which is www.blacktaxed, that's black tax with an ED, at the end of it, .com, www.blacktaxed.com. I am on LinkedIn. Just my name, Sean Rochester. I am on Facebook as the same name, as well as on Twitter as Black Taxed, and then Instagram as Black Taxed as well. Happy to, you know, feel free to reach out. Please buy the book and share it with far and wide, with your loved ones, with your colleagues. You will find it to be thorough, quantitative, and written in a way that provides extraordinary clarity.
And
go ahead, Richard.
Mr. Rochester, did you, because I seen that you had a second book and I was interested in, did you have that? Because I have to pass that by Ellie if it is CPR of the Soul,
for the Soul. So I have a second book that is written, hasn't been published yet. It's going to be coming out very, very shortly, probably, April or May. It's called CPR for the Soul, and it focuses on, SOUL is an acronym for stewardship, ownership, and legacy, right? I wrote the book because there's a lot of information that's out there about, you know, financial, management and the like. I think a lot of it focuses on what I call wealth allocation, which is you have a lot of money. How do you allocate it across different asset classes to generate, you know, intergenerational wealth? That generally is not our problem. Our issue is how do we accumulate the resources in the first place? So it's written with an eye on how to do that. It is, you know, it is powerful and focused. It's got, references to scripture to help people to know how to put these things into action starting today. I don't like people to waste my time and borrow my watch to tell them what time it is. So it's written in a way that's transformative and actionable. You can also pre-order that on the same website, www.blacktaxed.com. It is also transformative.
Mr. Rochester, I want to thank you for being with us, and I'll be in touch.
Gentlemen, I appreciate this opportunity to no end. Elliot, Richard, thank you very, very much. I enjoyed the conversation and look forward to keeping the dialogue going.
All right. Thank you, sir. Talk to you soon.
Soon.
Thank you.
Richard,
yes, sir.
Interesting conversation there. And I like the way he put these things out there and putting the numbers with them. I mean, that's one thing I can't do. The man has a master's degree in business. He can go in and get the numbers, flush them out, put the averages to them, and then show the raw, the raw numbers to what we're talking about. I can basically mention some of these points in history and show how our people, you know, what was done systematically to our people. But I'm glad that he put the numbers to a lot of these situations.
And it becomes really, really important because I really, being a believer in the repair and reparations, as we need to really be able to be armed with those numbers in relationship to when we're talking about reparations in a specific term, and not having people tell us how they want to deal with it. So by us knowing what the value was and what the value, the value that we actually are, and how much of a job creator, even in what we spend now, that is, it helps us kind of stay focused, but it also helps us be self-disciplined. Because as he said, we have to look at how much we are participating in our own economic suicide.
Yes. You know, and it's something that he said, excuse me, that I wanted to kind of go back to. When he mentioned, Richard, that it didn't matter to him whether they were doing this intentionally or unintentionally, that he wanted to focus in on the actions, the numbers, and what it was causing. Mm-hmm. Now, let me go back, because I want to play, I played it during the break, but I want to play this again, because I just want to focus in on what Dr. Anderson said, and he didn't say this yesterday. He said this a while ago, a number of years, in fact, but it hasn't changed. And I'll play that again, and maybe I'll go back to a couple of the callers there and see if they, especially the caller from Philadelphia, maybe he wanted to make a comment. Let me play this again, Richard.
I did a study in 1960. In that 1960, we had approximately 103 black elected officials in the entire United States. I did a social discomfort indicator study to find out what the conditions were of black folk were in 1960. I looked at the unemployment rate, the dysfunctional schools, dysfunctional family, joblessness, unemployment, income, everything, median family income. Then I waited 30 years until 1990 and did the exact same study to see what had happened. Why? Because in 1990, 30 years later, black folks' number of representatives in elected office has gone up over 9,000%. I said, if black folks have gone from 103 elected officials to 9,000, boy, we must be doing well in the country. I did the same exact study, discomfort indicator study, and found out that not only didn't black folks progress, guess what? They went backwards. They went backwards because there's no connection between putting a black person in office and getting benefits. None of them are going to do it. As soon as a black person gets elected to office, the first thing they're going to do is violate the sworn oath he just took. He'll swear it over and say, I'm sworn to get in the office to represent those people who elected me to office and serve them. As soon as a black person gets to office, first thing they'll say is that I'm here to take care of everybody.
Now, Richard, the reason I played that again is because black elected officials can be held responsible. Our people can point the finger at them in reference to this. Some of the things Mr. Rochester pointed out in regards to that black tax and how this system levies a tax on our people for just being black. Mm-hmm. These men and women could have done something about that. Now, we know it wouldn't end unless this system is obliterated, but they can do something to fight back against that. They can develop strategies to strengthen the economic situations in our communities, which will spill over into jobs, which will spill over into our schools. It has a spillover effect. But they haven't done anything in reference to the economic system situation in these communities. If you look, Richard, they done turned the economic situation in our communities over to other people. All of that is that's political, Richard. All of it is political. You can't open up businesses in other communities unless you go through zoning and a lot of times go through the elected officials in these communities. Because a lot of these communities are opening up businesses that, whether it's stop and goes or selling alcohol, food businesses, all of these things, those type of businesses are definitely political. They have to go through zoning. They have to be voted upon by the community. But a lot of times, at least in Philadelphia, a lot of these businesses, Richard, that pop up in the communities, how many times did they send a zoning notice to your house where mm-hmm. they telling you that this business wants to open up a stop and go, a bodega, a Chinese restaurant, and to come around and vote on it at the church, the local church or the community center? How many times have you gotten a notice? That is supposed to be done. If you, Richard, wanted to go in a white community and open up any type of store, I ain't even talking about the type of stores they open up in our communities, any type of store, whether you're selling hats, shoes, anything, they're going to have a zoning hearing on your proposal, and they'll let you know whether you'll be able to open up a store in their community, and most likely it'll be no. You've seen what happened up in the northeast section of Philadelphia with those two elected officials, two white elected officials, Bobby Heenan and the other guy, I forgot his name, that said that they didn't want any more street vendors up there in the northeast. Out, mm-hmm. out you go. And if they come back, that the northeast business conglomerate or whatever that is will make the decision whether they can come up there. And you know what that is, and you know who makes up that northeast business community.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things is political. Black elected officials could have done something about that, and they haven't. They all need to be held responsible for that.
Another example that ties into Mr. Rochester's, framework or PhD is that there the council president is offering universal income. Well, it would seem to me as a job creator, you need to force the government to provide more purchasing of companies or depositing more. And my thing is, we only got one black bank, in the city, which may be on a string. Well, where is the deposit, the city's deposits into that bank? Where is the university deposits into that bank? And by making those deposits, it could be able to provide the loans for, it can move into business loans to small black businesses in these here urban corridors in Philadelphia, which can be creating jobs within the neighborhoods that people are. These are the driving forces, but they as elected officials, they're not forcing, pushing policy legislation, as you mentioned about in relationship to zoning and having requirements in order to build. They're not pushing those government dollars into those types of institutions in order to create that ripple effect. They rather give $500 as an income to people. They say 100,000 people. That's not an economic development stimulator, as I can understand it, doing that. But that's black elected officials thinking at their best. But I don't want to leave it on them, because it's also the black electorate
that keeps voting for it. Yeah, yes. Yes, you're right. Let's swing back around a couple of the callers and let's see if, let's go back. 215. No, I don't know what's going on here. Let me go back to, because I know you probably want to go into open forum. Yes, sir.
Oh, how you doing, Brother Elliot?
Good.
Hey, Brother Richard. Elliot, once again, thanks to you and Brother Richard from my heart, man, for having Mr. Rochester on. What a beautiful brother, man. What a humble, and I know he's a very humble, brother and stuff, man. He just so, just a good dude, man. I just really enjoy this conversation, and I will get his book, Black Tax. Brother Elliot, before I talk about tying everything together with this economic engine in respect to black people, as you and Brother Richard know, if y'all didn't know, up in New York the other day, I was reading one of the New York papers at my friend's newsstand, and they said police beat up a 20-year-old black man the other day. Did y'all hear about that? They beat the brother up pretty. I ain't gonna say he wasn't on the level of Rodney King, but he took a decent beat down, put it that way. And stuff, up in New York the other day. Of course, they got with their phony investigation and stuff like that. I mean, and the brother, the only crime the brother may have committed, if you want to say committed, he was smoking a joint.
Yeah, they said he was smoking weed in public or something like that.
Exactly. So, so because of that, he deserved to be beat down like that. Wow. White boys get drunk, defecate, doing the Eagles Super Bowl thing, and they tearing up property, but they don't take a beat down. But this brother smoking a weed, he gets a beat down. Unbelievable. Welcome to America. Well, anyway, Brother Elliot and Richard, let me say this to y'all. Tying up with Mr. Rochester said, and which in a clip you played from one of my heroes, Dr. Claude Anderson, and I have his book, Black Labor, White Wealth, and stuff. I had a chance to, in fact, Dr. Anderson autographed that for me personally several years ago. He autographed it for me personally. Anyway, when you played the clip, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, y'all played a clip of Al-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, better known to the world as Malcolm X. When y'all played the clip where Malcolm say, y'all put the Democrats first, and they put y'all last. You know, that famous clip you play all the time, Elliot. Mm. Well, once again, Brother Elliot, you see that in action. Black folks put that creep Joe Biden first, and he, of course, he, if he becomes president, which I pray that he don't, but if he does, he will put them last. And see, it's just the sad part about it. You see this disconnect between older blacks and younger blacks. Older black people throughout the South say their bums high because were it not for older blacks, Biden candidates would be dead. He would be, his candidates would be dead. Black, older blacks in Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Alabama, they saved that bum. And that's why his candidacy is alive. But you see younger black people are for Bernie. And so that's to show you the disconnect. The old Negroes like James Clyburn, again, that old guard is why you have such a discontent between black people. Now, and what gets me is when I heard a lot of these older blacks, they act like Joe Biden has been some kind of friend of black people. I don't even have time, Brother Allen, to go into this man's history, all the rotten racist stuff he has did towards black, from his, from back when he was in the Senate. Earth, I go by a man's record speaks for itself. I'll go by his record back in the 70s when he was a senator in the 70s, how he was friends with two of the most racist senators, Eastland, and both of them deceased now, James Eastland and this other a bigot. Both of them was pretty much avowed Klansmen.
You're talking about Strom Thurmond.
Joe Biden. Was Elliot?
Strom Thurmond.
Yeah, well, no, I know about Thurmond, but Thurmond, I'm going to save him for last, but there was another one from Georgia. It was two of them at that time, and he was friends with him, but and stuff, and they was friends with Joe Biden's, but on Strom Thurmond, that's another one, that's three. Strom Thurmond, when he passed, Joe Biden did a eulogy at his funeral in South Carolina, and Strom Thurmond always referred to Joe Biden affectionately as his son. So I'm saying to myself, how the hell can black people be that stupid to think that somebody who Strom Thurmond called a son is some friend of black people? And we ain't got to go into all the stuff he has said over the years about urban predators and urban terror. You know he was talking about black. He didn't have to use the word black. You know who Biden was talking about and the insults he has made over the years. And another thing, that these older blacks in the South that voted for Biden, they're going to kick them right up there behind, because it's no secret, Brother Elliot and Richard, that Biden for years, even when he was a senator, even during the years he was Obama's VP, this man, just like the Republicans, he got an itch for Social Security. He has been wanting to join in with his Republican cohorts to cut people's Social Security. And you know, for a lot of black folks, I mean white folks too, but for a lot of elderly black people, that Social Security is their lifeline. If Biden get in there and start cutting with these black people's Social Security checks, they're going to realize they got just what they deserve instead of voting for somebody like him. I'm not understanding this fantasy about Joe Biden being a friend of black. I just don't understand it. And again, to me, it fits that parable when you play about Malcolm. You put him first, and he's going to damn sure put black people last. But when I say last, he first thing going to do is go after any kind of things like Social Security, anything that can, that's a lifeline of black people. Joe Biden going to go after with a vengeance. And them Negroes like James Clyburn, I'm going to hold them accountable because they're pushing this man knowing he's a vile racist and stuff like that. I mean, it's a sin and a shame to the creator, this thing about Joe Biden, like he's some kind of friend of black. He's never been a friend of black people, man, you know? But, you know, Elliot, I'll just close with these last couple of remarks. See, this is why it's so important for our people to have history and to know your history. That way you won't keep on making these uninformed decisions when it comes to the electorate. Because that's one thing Mary Mayster always said about having to keep a scorecard. So when you're an informed voter, you don't vote for individuals that's against your best interest. But when you're an uninformed voter and you just go listen to the okey-doke instead of researching these people for yourself, you can tell you vote for these who have no stake in doing right by black people. Just keep voting for these people over and over again. And I find it ironic, Elliot and Richard. I heard a lot of the Negroes now, this goes back to what Dr. Claude Anderson was saying on terrestrial radio. They keep on saying, well, if Bernie becomes a nominee, or even in this case, Biden, which would be a waste of time for sure, but they keep on saying, well, if Biden or Bernie becomes the Democrat nominee or ultimately becomes the president, we got to go to them for black agenda. And I said to myself, no problem. I got no problem with that. Even though I know what Biden wouldn't make no difference. He's not even thinking on them terms. But my point is that it's so ironic, Elliot. Let's go back to what Dr. Claude Anderson was saying about these black elected officials. Now, when Barack Obama was president, not only in 08, And when you brought it up about having a black agenda in 08, first thing the Negro said, well, you can't expect him to say, do all those things because he plays for everybody and stuff. You got to let him do four more years. Then when he becomes their second time, he can do it. He said, when it came up again, when after he served the 4 years, he ran back and got elected in 2012, reelected. The Negro said the same old dumb stuff. Well, you can't expect him just to be the president for black people. He's president for everybody. And I'm saying to myself, it's so ironic. The same voices, I keep a scroll call like Mary Mason say, the same voices now are demanding that Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders having a black agenda, but they didn't have that black agenda when it came to Barack Obama. You know what I mean? It's just amazing, man. All of a sudden, you want the two white boys to have an agenda, but you didn't do it for the so-called first black president. And like Dr. Clarence has said, it kills me when I heard Negroes say that. And that goes on the city level, the state and federal level. Whenever a black elected official, for the most part, get elected, first thing them Negroes say out of their mouth, even though they might get 95% black vote, first thing them Negroes say, I'm the mayor for all the people. I'm the governor for all the people. I'm the senator for all the people. I'm the president. But yet, it wasn't all the people that voted for you. It wasn't for 90% black folks voted for Obama in both times, you would have been president. But it's all but them niggas, they get you behind it because they come with that same nonsense. But you never heard Donald Trump saying, I'm the president for everybody, or this one, or that Clinton say he's the president for everybody. But it's always the Negro that got to say he's the president or the mayor for everybody. I get so tired, like Dr. Clark, I get so tired of that rhetoric. And whenever black politics and say that, you know automatically he's going to kick black people right up there behind. John Street, the former mayor of Philadelphia, and I close with this, Ellen, so somebody else could get on. John Street was right here in Philadelphia during his second term. This Negro spoke at the Union Hall, Ellen. This showed the disdain they got for black people. They would never say this to a white audience. He spoke down at the Union Hall down on Delaware Avenue, the Sheet Metals Workers Union. He spoke to a predominantly all-black audience, and black people was down there telling Street that some things they wanted that they can benefit the black community here in Philadelphia. This guy got up there and told those, let me tell you something. He says with exact words verbatim. He says, look, I know I'm black, y'all black. He said, I know y'all voted for me and all that stuff. He said, just because I'm black, don't think you're going to get any special favors because I'm black. I don't get into that. He talked real nasty. Now, that Negro would have never said that to no white people. See, this is the kind of disdain they got for black people. The same with Barack Obama when he made the infamous comment to the Congressional Black Caucus, stop crying, put your bedroom slippers on and stop crying and all that kind. He would have never said that to a Jewish audience, you know what I mean? But they saw that disdain that they can say that to black people, but even why they say it, because black people let them get away with it. See, people only let you get away with what you allow, Brother Ellen Richard. Since black people allow that kind of disrespect, this is why the Barack Obamas and the John Streets of the world disrespect black people, and they will continue to disrespect black people, and they go for James Clyburn as well in South Carolina. They will continue to disrespect black people, long as black people keep on taking it. That's the bottom line. I can't make it no more plainer than that. Long as you take disrespect, well, disrespect is what you're going to get, brother. Simple as that. Well, Ellen Richard, thanks for the time and stuff, man. And again, thanks for having Mr. Rochester on. I'll sit back and listen to the rest of the show, and I'm going to definitely get his book. Somebody get paid next week, I'm going to order his book off of www.blacktax.com for sure.
You know, before you go, Richard and Joe, I know you heard that, and I kind of figured this was going to happen, and I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. And when I say the other shoe, Jesse just came out today and said that he's endorsing Sanders.
Yeah, right.
But it's right before that primary, so I knew that he was going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think the last time we talked, I told you that he would do it before that Michigan primary.
Right.
So you got one more guy that's waiting for his shit to drop. Yeah.
Prime Daddy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Prime Daddy, I can tell you right now, he's going to endorse Biden. And Jesse only doing it for strategic reasons right now, but Jesse ultimately going to support Biden too. But Perm, that as Jay would say, he definitely going to support Biden because he's part of clearly the Democratic establishment. See, Jesse, you know what? I'm glad you put up. See, Jesse may do it because Jesse's still in a lot of ways still disrespected by the Democrat Party. So Jesse might do it out of spite work. The same way I told you about Keith Ellison in Minnesota, who I've lost a lot of respect for. Well, Keith Ellison came out and supported Bernie Sanders, and I told. Remember, I made this point to you and Richard a while ago. I said, I'm glad Keith Ellison supporting Bernie, but I said the reason why I'm going to keep doing it is because he felt disrespected by Obama, because by everybody knows that Keith Ellison should be the head of the DNC and not Tom Perez. But Barack Obama made sure that Perez got it over Keith Ellison, and that's why Keith Ellison's upset. That's why he supported. If he would have, in other words, Ellen Richard, if Barack Obama wouldn't have interfered and let Keith Ellison become the head of the DNC, there's no doubt in my mind that Keith Ellison would have followed proper protocol, and he would have went on it like the rest of them niggas supported Joe Biden. But because he's so hurt personally, that's why he's supporting Bernie Sanders. Not because he likes Bernie necessarily or he believes them, because he brought it out of spite. And that's what happens a lot of time with these Negroes. When a white man or they get kicked by the system, then all of a sudden they want to do something radical all of a sudden. Not that they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart or they think it should be the right thing, because they feel personally hurt by it. And that's why I say with Jesse, I think Jesse's supporting Bernie because Jesse still feels disrespected by the Democrat Party. They disrespected Jesse both times in 84. And believe me, I'm no fan of Jesse per se, but I'm just putting it out there. Jesse felt disrespected how they treated him at the convention in 84 and 88. So this might be Jesse's way of getting back at them. So since you put it out there like that, that's why I believe Jesse's supporting Bernie, because he's so hurt, like Keith Ellison. He's still kicked in the behind. So this is a way of getting back at the Democratic establishment, you know. So, you know. But thanks, Ellen, Brother Richard. Good show, man, and stuff, man. I will sit back and listen to the rest of the show. We got a lot of, like Ellen, Richard, we got a lot of work to do, man, because, like I say, all these Negroes will be jumping for crumbs. They're going to be at Joe Biden's doorstep now, begging for the little crumbs off the master's table now. They're going to be, some of the Negroes will sell their own mother down the drain just to get some of the goodies from the Biden camp. But these Negroes are pitiful, man. They are a disgrace in this life, and they're a disgrace in the next life. But thanks, Brother Ellen, Richard. Yeah, peace to y'all, brothers.
All right.
Richard, you know, the blueprint and the solutions are out there. You got people working. It's just got to be more cohesiveness in what we're doing. And I'm not saying that I got no solutions for all of it, but you know, you have people out there with independent black parties, and if we're going to be involved in politics, that's going to be the solution to try to politically control these areas that we populate. And especially now that a lot of black folks is moving back down south, they need to go back down there with a strategy.
Yeah.
A political strategy and an economic strategy. All of it ties together.
Right.
An educational strategy. It needs to be a strategy. Don't just move all around. In fact, people came when they during the period of that so-called Great Migration. Some of our ancestors that came up from down south, they did have a loose strategy. They wanted a better life for their families. They wanted them to be educated. Some of them was coming from those farms and all where they didn't get much education. They wanted their children to be educated. They wanted a better life for their families. And they wanted to provide for them economically. And plus, they were coming to areas, Richard, that was economically controlled by our people. During that period, the neighborhoods that our people were moving into, a lot of the businesses at that time were controlled by black folks. The doctors in the community were black. The community banks were black. The insurance people, you know, a lot of things. Sure, you did have some other nationalities sprinkled in that was making money off the black community. But the overwhelming majority of the businesses in the black community at that time were black. But things have changed. And, you know, it's not, we're in a constant struggle here and been in a constant struggle since we've been here. That ought to let our people know that we have to come up with a different solution.
Right.
I mean, every generation, you're fighting to keep this right. You're fighting to keep that right. You're fighting to keep your Voting Rights Act. You're fighting for civil rights. You're fighting for this. When does the fighting stop? When do we realize that, just like Dr. King said, putting faith in people that have too often proved to be unfaithful? Now we're fighting over which slave master is better for black folks. You're Bernie Sanders or Biden. Most black folks, you'll end up in jail before you end up living in Vermont, according to statistics. Yeah. It's more blacks in jail. It's only 1%. That's one of the whitest states in this country. You only got 1% of black folks living in Vermont. And the one representative they had was run out of office by a racist. And she wasn't run out of office in the 1930s, Richard, or the 40s. She was run out of office, 2 years ago?
Right.
Her home was invaded, the racist graffiti. She was virtually run out of office. She said she couldn't take it anymore. But it's more blacks living, it's more blacks in jail than living in the state. According to percentages. So, you know, that's what black folks are choosing from, when we should be able to come into our communities, into our churches, temples, mosques, social organizations, clubs or whatever, and come up with better solutions to guide our neighborhoods and better solutions for our children than to keep on with this Democratic Republican merry-go-round.
You got to keep on pushing it and keep on pushing the information, you know, the work on to get people to see that they're biased against their own self and the impact of that. That is no, as you know, as they say, is written on the wall, know thyself.
Listen, before we go this evening, I just want to give the lineup Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. Always interesting dialogue on African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. That's from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. From 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. From 6 to 8 on Time for an Awakening. We got one more caller that just jumped on. You want to take it, Richard? Let's go,
okay.
Let's go to 646. 646.
Hello?
646.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
646.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Greetings, brother. This is Brother Maurice Carver, man, calling you from New York City.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good, brothers. I just wanted to jump into the conversation because that last brother was so on point. It was interesting. But my thing that I think I was thinking about was this whole political process. Now, Jesse, the political party wouldn't be as open as it is without Jesse Jackson. So in terms of, you know, people being disrespectful to Jesse, I mean, you might not agree with his politics, but without him running, without him pushing and opening up the democratic process, you wouldn't see a Kamala Harris or any of these other people of color. Now, one of the things I was thinking about was when we look at this whole idea of what's going on, I asked a question on my show. I asked the question, you know, do we really know Joe Biden, right? Do we really know who he is? Because Clyburn keeps saying that, and the brother was 100% right about that. What do we really know about him? And then you go back and you look at his history, and you say there's not really much that he's done that we should be that ingrained into him. So my question was, what did the political elite, because that's who made the deal, what did the political elite sell themselves for in this particular situation? What are they asking to get something out of, you know, from this Democratic Party? And I don't know that. I mean, Kamala Harris just endorsed Biden. Mm-hmm. She went after him talking about, you know, busing, but then she endorsed him. So what did you get? And then, and even when you look at some of the people of color that was candidates, I mean, were they any better than the white people that was running? In terms of you look at the impact in the communities, were they any better? Ask yourself that question. So, I mean, and one other thing I just wanted to make a mention in terms of economics that I noticed, right? I'm calling you from New York City, and you know, the coronavirus is breaking out over here and stuff. And one thing I noticed that I thought was real interesting was I walked by and I walked into one of these Chinese restaurants, right? Chinese restaurant had actually shut down a couple of days because nobody was going there. And I wondered to myself, of course, all these Chinese restaurants in black neighborhoods losing a lot of money because people are not going there. And I wondered to myself, did people learn the economic lesson behind that? I said, wow, that's a powerful tool. Because when I walked into the place, it was, hello, sir, how you doing? What can I do for you? I thought I was white when I walked in there. I thought I was white. I said to myself, what's going on here? They were so glad to get somebody's business. And I said to myself, if people could understand the economic power that they have, boy, they could make a difference and stuff. And we were arguing that issue up here because we've been in New York, we've been fighting over the specialized schools test where a lot of these schools where blacks and Latinos have been shut out of, these specialized high schools, a lot of the Asians in there, and they're fighting against the they're fighting against keeping the schools exactly the same way they are. And I told black people, I said on my show, I said, if we just stop going to the nail salons, we stop going to the Chinese restaurants or whatever, I think we'll get a different attitude out of them and stuff. And then now, because of all this stuff going on, the city of New York is putting out these loans to help these people.
Mm-hmm.
But then talking again about the city of New York, let's talk about our mayor who said the black people voted for Bloomberg or voted for Biden without really knowing what they were doing and stuff. And I thought that was an interesting comment and stuff. I never want to call people ignorant about what they're doing, because we really don't know if a person is ignorant or not. You don't know the person individually, and you don't know why those people made those decisions. You don't know what deals were made in those states with those people and stuff, because we all know that there's some backroom deal that's going on. You know this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because people remember their history and stuff. When we talk about, I asked the question, right? Should Bloomberg get the same treatment that George Wallace got? If people don't remember who George Wallace was, segregation today, segregation now, segregation forever. Yet black people, when he ran for office, they supported him.
They voted for him.
But
yeah,
there was some type of political deal behind that. So we have to be careful when we start talking about people being ignorant about stuff, because you don't know what the deals are. And my question is always,
let me mention this.
Yeah.
Now, it was a political deal for the black elected official that guided the populace
to vote
for.
See, that's exactly the point I'm making.
Okay.
So what did the political elite get out of this, right? What did the political elite get out of this in terms of the deal? And then if you look at George Wallace and stuff, money started trickling in. Now, I'm not endorsing the racist. Now, let's be clear about that. Okay, let's be 100% clear. But we know politics is a dirty game, and people have to understand that. I'm not in love with any of these candidates and stuff. Not one of them. Not one. I'm just wondering, what's the deal here? What is the deal that they made?
The color, color of perspective I bring, I see it as is that those people, those black elected officials, and the operatives are fighting for their life. I'm taking a position that Bernie coalition represents a whole different group that can take over the Democratic Party. And if they take over the Democratic Party, those individuals are out. Their patronage people are out, because those are a different group that are not in the party as of right now. The people in the party right now, the black representatives in the party right now, and the patronage people they have at the various levels, state and local level, they are always been operating as moderates in the Democratic Party. When I say moderates, what I see is they always been in alignment with the corporation, the global corporations, national corporations. Well, the Bernie coalition, which is primarily young, are saying they're not in line with the global corporation, national corporations, and the wealthy. If they come in, they will do the research, they will do the advocacy, they will hold the positions that will take money from them to provide for these social programs. Yes, there's going to be some bartering. What happens to those blacks who've been in there for the last 50 years, and now there's a new generation, the Kamalas and all of them? They're going to be moved out, because they're going to be, these people who come under Bernie are going to be pushing for different type of candidates down at the local level, candidates that will have social, quote unquote, social democracy, who will be more about supplying, using government as a means of supporting people who can't, to a certain degree, who can't support themselves. So that's why I say they are in their survival mode. And the corporations, the Bloomberg and all of them, they're in keeping their pockets closed. That's why they're participating. They didn't have to do that. They didn't have to be out front with Obama. And they didn't have to be out front with Bush the younger, or Bush the elder, or with Reagan. They could have stayed in the background, you know. But now, with the wave of these young people who are saying they don't want to carry this debt till they're 50 years old, they don't want to be without a job, They don't want to live with their mothers. You know, they don't want to be working in even Starbucks or working two or three different jobs in order to just to survive. They want government support. Well, how are you going to pay for it? The moderates say, how are you going to pay for it? We're going to tax the wealthy. We're going to tax the corporations. And yes, we'll pay. We'll be willing to pay more taxes for health care. We'll be willing to pay more taxes to my so my grandmother or my mother and father can be able to get their Social Security. We're willing to pay some more taxes if we can get a job of a living wage. We'll be willing to pay the taxes for that. But the moderates are saying, no, we don't want to do that. And the black people are caught up in that. Now, in the culture, I think the value at the cultural level, black people in the South and black people in general have always been, what I want to say, if you look historically, they have always been financial conservatives. Mm-hmm. Always been. Now, when we say financial conservatives, that value system aligns with the rich and the corporations. That's what that value system aligns with. So when they hear the Bernie and them talk about they want to tax the rich, or they want more government, they anti companies and pro government spending. Well, for a black value system that is fiscally conservative, I mean, you know, they're not in line with that. You know, even if they don't have it, even if we don't have anything, they're not in line because the value system. So it makes sense politically that they would go with a Biden, you know, a good old boy. And they're in their South. And I don't think it's just about deals. Look at the South. The South is a system that's been developed, and we talked about it earlier, under coercion, cultural coercion, whether you say lynching. I mean, we just went all the way through mm-hmm. where they actually put policies in place to hurt black people, hurt black upper and middle class people. Well, you don't think that affects the generations, their children, as far as seeing that happen, or their children's children? And still living in the South. Now, there's people moving back South, but the people who are living in the South, there's people, when he talked about, what's that thing about the sharecropper? Mm-hmm. I think, Elliot, we interviewed was a Sister Harrell mm-hmm. who went around doing the genealogy. There are still sharecroppers today. Mm. So that's not people free will. That's coercion. Economic coercion, those people who are living in those towns that got hookworms in Alabama, that's coercion. You know, so as you say, and I agree, we can't just suspect, but we have to understand the psychology and the politics, the historical politics that are dealing, and what these people, they're fighting for their lives, because it ain't even about Trump, I'm arguing. It's about the Democratic Party. And Jesse was also about fighting the Democratic Party, the moderates in the Democratic Party in 84 and 88. And he got money from the corporations to you know, whatever it was, that rainbow and all of that, you know, he was going to try to get jobs into the corporations, creating some kind of funnel thing, you know. And then his son got all caught up, but, you know, all that aside. So that's what I'm saying. That is, if that Bernie wing comes into the Democratic Party, them Negroes are out.
Yeah,
all the way down to the local level.
Yep.
And I think that's the most important thing, because I think all politics start locally. And I think that you're 100% right, that people need to make changes in terms of looking at these people who are diametrically opposed to anything, their existence. The whole system is diametrically opposed to their existence, and they need to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I remember we were having a debate one time with some of these young people, and they were saying that, you know, it's the older people's fault that the way they live right now, that they have to live at home with their parents mm-hmm. and all these different things of that nature. And I was like, let me tell you something, man. You know, people always be talking about Reagan, man, but Clinton was worse than Reagan ever was.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton was worse than Reagan ever was. And if you go back and look at all the policies he put into place, man, you know, you would think to yourself, you'd be like, man, he moved the Democratic Party. So, I mean, the principle that Bernie is talking about is what the party used to be about. Mm. Okay. People, you go back and study history. The party used to, all that stuff was platforms, was normal.
And that was only under Roosevelt, you know, and that was only because of the downturn of the Great Depression. And it was either that or have an internal revolution.
Yeah.
And everybody lose.
Yeah, he had to do something. Yeah.
He had to do that, you know, and he had to do that with the wealthy, the you know, those, that wealthy class fighting, kicking and screaming at that time. You know,
and you know,
so,
I was listening to something else. I just wanted to mention, because you mentioned something about Social Security, right? And I thought it was very interesting, because I was looking at Social Security, for example, right? Most Black people don't get Social Security like through retirement. Majority of them get it through disability,
right?
And so, and then when you look at the average length of people's lives, I'm like, why do I keep hearing all these people telling Black people to wait till they're 70 years old to get Social Security, when the average age where Black people pass away is like 73, something like that. So I said to myself, you know, I mean, that's you getting nothing out of the system that you've been paying in all your life. I said, if anything, it makes more sense to go in earlier. And I'm not giving any financial advice, disclaimer being said right now. But I'm saying like it makes more sense for you to go into 62, because if you live up to a certain point, then it averages out. Because the majority, again, don't get Social Security. Most of them get it on disability. And this is not me even saying, even, what was his name? President Bush even said that, the second Bush. Not the only time he said anything that I agree with. He was like, yeah, most people die before they even had a chance to collect it. So, I mean, when you look at all of that type of stuff and you say to yourself, you know, fear also has something, Richard, to do with what happens with this whole, you stick with what's familiar versus what you don't know. Mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders is an unknown. You know, this whole idea of Green Party and, you know, Green Initiative, all this type of stuff like that is different. And so people have to, you know, we have to see more about what that is, what it's about. It has to be, you know, I'm not saying it has to be explained to us like we're on a sixth grade level, but it needs to be explained to people so that they can understand what we're moving into in the future.
But well, I would say what we have to do is stop thinking about ourselves and think about our children's children. We have to think from there. What is it that we want them to have? Not what we want to have or we going to get. What is it? Because the game is being set up that they're not going to have anything. If they have zero government resources, if they have, they maintain the, and you mentioned, just mentioned about the educational fight, that structural educational fight that you're having in New York, which they're having here. Mm-hmm. The children in those schools now, their children will be in worse condition, because what's being fought for right now is just for those children who are children in the school system right now. But we can need to be fighting for their children's children, not for them. Then we are looking in the future and trying to create policy and pushing our politics about that. Because as long as we're dealing with immediacy, they got us.
But brother, let me just say this to you. I agree that, you know, a man that doesn't plan for the future fails in the present. But the thing is this, the stuff that they're doing now is so insidious that we have to fight the battle right now for the present. Because when we're dealing, I mean, I was telling Elliot before, I mean, people ain't even paying attention to this whole thing with artificial intelligence and facial recognition and all the stuff that's going on with that, and how that impacts Black people's lives all over the country. From you getting quote unquote unemployment, from you getting Social Security benefits, for you getting, you know, arrested, for you getting bail. This is a systematic debacle, and it's folk. They always start with running that stuff in your particular community, perfect it, and then they expand it out. And so that's what my concern is. That it is such a problem right now. And I agree with the future, but we got to fight the stuff that's going on today. We got to fight it like our life depended on it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you. I mean, it's because I'm. You look at this whole thing with you're talking about the future, right? Most of these people that talk about automation, right? A lot of these people, they're outsourcing their jobs. Now you have Amazon, which is the biggest leader in all of this crap. They're changing the way people work or whatever, and no one's even paying any attention. Because people don't care, because as long as their 401k go up, it doesn't matter to them.
With that being said, and automation and the growing out of the technology of surveillance, as you say, now is only testing, developing. In those children's future, that will be their life. They will, and again, you won't even have to go to jail. You know, you will have, I mean, I think Elliot, they were saying here, the policy about putting cameras on the street around the school in relation, using the whole thing of a street shooting, you know, as a thing, you will be seen. And then when you get in school, you're actually in school and actually being watched through cameras, so really you'll be watched. They will be watched. Society will be constructed for them if we allow it, to where every move they make will be under surveillance. Well, what difference is that
there
compared to slavery? What difference is that
it's
compared to
slavery?
Right. So, but the thing is, as you said, it will be more perfected by the time, because we're only talking about 20 years, right? A child is in school now from 12th grade. I mean, that from there, they go in at six, they go 12 years, they're 18. So we're talking from now, 12 years, the technology, look at the 12 years technology development has been in the lifetime of our 12 years.
You know, I was talking to one of my friends. I'm sorry, Richard. Go ahead.
Okay.
I was talking to one of my friends 10 years ago and he was looking at this whole idea of Facebook and all of that. And he said to me, he said, you know, that's like a psychological profile if you think about it, right? That's like a psychological test that it analyzes who you are and what you're about. It connects the dots for everybody. And then you look at this whole idea of big data and your information, and they're selling it to corporations. You look at the situation where you have this DOS system in New York City, for example, which is the domain system, which gathers information from all different sources and stuff, and it creates a profile about you, and then it shares that information. You know, Microsoft is involved with developing that particular technology, and they're trying to sell that across the country. Because, you know, anything that's perfected in New York, okay, because NYPD, New York City Police Department, is the largest police department in the world. They send that stuff out to other places and stuff, and they buy it, and their mentality in terms of how they use it, and they're surveilling us, because you know they didn't have enough information in the system. You saw what Google was doing down in Atlanta, trying to get homeless people so they could take images of their faces, but now they got all of these police cameras around our schools with the premise of it being safe. A police camera ain't never stopped nobody from doing nothing. And you have all of these traffic cameras around and all this stuff, and even your personal systems, all that stuff feeds into their systems. You got people up here in New York, they can't even get into their buildings because they got rid of keys. You have to use your face to get into a building. If the system doesn't recognize you, you can't get in.
And they said the facial recognition system right at this moment is biased against black people.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is, right? But what is it?
Yeah. But but when it gets to the party, when you look at both of those as it relates to us, where in the party is this discussion taking place? We see it.
Exactly.
We see it.
Exactly.
We, you know, where is it taking place? Because those white folks know it, and they ain't got no problem with it. And I'm saying those young white folks coming to the party now, whether they win now with Bernie or not, they're going to eventually be in. The question is, where are we? And that's taking in our internal conflict.
Richard, let me take this one last comment before we wind things down. Let's go back to Newport News. Newport News?
Yes, gentlemen. I just want to inject
Wait. Are you there?
Mm-hmm. Repeat that. Go ahead.
I just want to inject one thing. I heard the gentleman say Microsoft is doing. I learned, sitting on the ground of Mr. Salo, when Ingersoll Rand and Martin Marietta were competitors, there is no such thing as one private entity doing this. For instance, he bought up Microsoft. Amazon bought a company called Ring. And the same surveillance that he's talking about, the way they are competing is by they bought Ring. Then rather than go to a large metropolitan area, what they've been doing is giving Ring to the police departments in rural areas to perfect the technology of facial recognition and target it, what? Households telling people you can enhance your security. And the other point I wanted to make, the other thing they do to us when you talk about both parties, Nancy Pelosi made a comment in her weekly press conference that most people didn't catch. That $8 billion they just had a bipartisan agreement with, that they gave more money for the coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
After a foreign reporter asked her a question, you know what she ended up saying? She didn't give the numbers, but I'm about to search for them. I made a note. Part of that $8 billion was over surveillance enhancement in the U.S. So they told you they spent $8 billion for a potential pandemic, when in reality, what they did is what we grew up in my age of 66 called pork barrel. Part of that $8 billion is actually money for to further surveillance on citizens. I'll stop there.
Thank you for your contribution. Richard, oh, Maurice is off. I wanted him to kind of billboard when the next Black Man Screaming is on. But I got to get him on, man, because he had some. I told you he emailed us some stuff here about businesses. And,
yeah, I see. I read it.
Yeah, that'll be good. That'll be a good subject. I'll get him. We'll kind of plan something out there. But Black Man Screaming is on in New York. It's on in Denver. It's on in New Orleans. I think it's on in Los Angeles. It's on in several cities. So it's good to have Maurice drop by and add something to the program. Again, yes. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. And, let me finish that. I kind of lost my train of thought there. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. Always interesting dialogue and subjects on African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. That's 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 6 to 8 on Monday evenings. Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. That's 6 to 8 on Time for An Awakening Media. From 9 to 10, Nicobas program, Operation Reparations, is on. And they were on last week. They on the first and third Monday of every month on Tuesdays. Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for An Awakening Media. Be a new program starting up in about another 2 weeks on Time for An Awakening, and it'll probably be
this conference has reached in the morning duration and will end in 1 minute.
In the mornings. But we'll get to that because I want to have the host come on and kind of billboard her program. But on Fridays, Time for Awakening is back from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. Thank you. such a small part of.
To save the children.